Okay, good morning, Dr. Ogielski. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of this interview, the main purpose of our discussion is to talk about the period during which replica symmetry breaking was formulated and understood, roughly from 1975 to 1995. But before we get to that, I'd like to ask you a few questions on background so that we can help situate your contributions. First, how did you first get interested in physics and then to pursue a research career in theoretical physics and quantum field theory in particular?
Well, that's actually easy to answer. I think I always liked science, and I always found things that I was learning in high school a little too easy. So when I went to university and started studying physics, classical physics, which we started with those days, was also very easy and not challenging until I hit quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics became very difficult for me. So at this time, I really took to reading everything I could and solving all problems I could solve to get a grasp of what it's all about. And then I naturally gravitated towards quantum field theory because that's what majority of physicists at my university were doing. And I started there as a postdoc and eventually emigrated to the United States. So quantum field theory was a dominant subject of studies. I think it still is actually at the University of Wrocław. The nice thing about it is that this was the hometown and home university of Max Born. I think now the Institute of Theoretical Physics there is called Max Born Institute. And Born is one of my all-time favorite physicists with his enormous range of interests. And then you see, I traveled throughout Europe. I had various assistant professorships and similar positions until I got recruited by Bell Laboratories in 1982. And
So, just before we get to that, could you try to get a bit closer to the mic? We're having a bit of a sound issue. Sorry about this. And actually, I wanted to talk to you about your peregrination before joining Bell Labs. So you said shortly after your PhD, you did join the Institute of Theoretical Physics at Wrocław. And apologies for the pronunciation. And you seem to have a to, you were working fairly independently at that point, and you traveled abroad quite a lot. So
Yes, that's true.
Can you was that a common path? And can you tell us a bit what drove your selection of research problems at that point?
I started with Lagrangian quantum field theory, which is what my advisor was doing. And these were the years of the discovery of asymptotic freedom, Wilson's renormalization group, meaning late 70s. And I was very much drawn, especially to Wilson's renormalization group theory. So I could leverage opportunities of certain grants or invitations and continue in this direction, mostly in Western Europe, prior in Germany, in Kaiserslautern, but also in France. And in Dijon and several other places. So I think that by the end of 70s, my primary interests were in lattice quantum field theory, renormalization group, and more geometric approaches, I would say, to lattice field theory. I got quite acquainted with the work of Sasha Polyakov, whom I met numerous times in Boston, Russia, and in Poland, and Sasha Migdal. So just, for a moment, I was very much interested in quantum loop theory and lattice formulation of that. So that's more or less where I landed at Bell Labs.
So how did, oh, sorry, how is it that you ended up at Bell Labs? What led to your recruitment there?
I emigrated to the United States, and I was a research associate for for a few months at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. And one of the regular recruiters from Bell Labs, the strategy they had that the senior scientists from Bell Labs would once or twice a year visit their own schools. just to chat with senior professors, you know, whom they should talk to, who is available. Because Bell Labs operated on the principle of constant refreshment of talent. And if you read, say, Phil Anderson's book about his years at Bell Laboratories, he explains it pretty well. There was this magic concept of headcount, and some percentage, which was not known to the members of technical staff, but was known to management, which I became later, so I learned it, had to go every year. Okay, and new people had to be brought in. So there was a very strict mechanism, I think more strict earlier and slightly less strict maybe when Bell Labs ended as an AT&T entity, to finding new talent. So I met this guy, and that's the first place when I'll tell you I just would have to look somewhere to find his name. He was from a different part of Bell Labs that I did not work in. And I was invited to Bell Laboratories for an interview, and I got a postdoc position. And that's how I got there. So I was in there's several interesting things about Bell Labs that you have to know. One is the numbering strategy. So all departments had numbers, starting with physics. So of course, you are a theoretical physicist, so you know that that's the most important science there is, right? So theoretical physics department was number 11111, okay? One was for research, 11 was for basic research and so forth. So 111, I think, was physics research or something like it. I can look it up for you somewhere. So anyway, and then you see, I had a second new interest. I got hooked up on software programming on a very basic level. When I was in Europe, then again, you have to look back. It's way, way, way back in time. We were using programmable calculators to do, you know, basic symbolic calculations, like Hewlett-Packard or Texas Instruments, big kind of, you know, engineering style boxes. And I was absolutely fascinated doing symbolic calculations with this machine. So when I came to Bell Labs, my first project was to do Monte Carlo simulations to determine what possibly could be the renormalized limit of a variant of phi to the fourth scalar quantum field theory that was proposed by John Clauder. So I was working with John Clauder at first. He was the editor of Journal of Mathematical Physics this time. And I got my hands on the Cray. That's, you know, today your iPhone has more computing power than a supercomputer in 1982. But then it was a fantastic machine that sort of looked futuristic, octagonal column, okay, with a seat out of all things all around it. And I think this work turned out pretty good. And I started looking, you see, to where should I apply my newly discovered skills with computers. And you know, given that Phil Anderson was in the lab that I was in the Department of Theoretical Physics, but also people from Michael Fisher's group at Cornell. So there was David Hughes, there was Dan Fisher, son of Michael Fisher, and several other people who did significant contributions, you know, in phase transitions and randomization group theory and things related to this matter. Maybe I should also mention Ravi Bhatt was there. And the rest of the group was primarily quantum many body physics, you know, the hardcore condensed matter theory of the Phil Anderson type. It was obvious, you know, right away that the biggest unanswered questions were in the spin glass area, or actually a little more generally, in the area of random magnetic systems. So it's Ising spin glasses, then random field ferromagnets, dilute antiferromagnets, and several others. And additional, you know, stimulation was that the labs had this property that no matter what field you chose in physics, you could bet that there's going to be a world-class expert somewhere in one of these long hallways, and you could talk to them. So there were several people doing beautiful experiments on related materials, to random magnetic materials. I eventually ended up collaborating with a really nice guy, Doug Osherov's group, Laurent Levy, who is now, I think he's still in Grenoble, actually. Very high precision experiments. So having said that, the first problem was that it didn't take me very long to realize that you just can't compute anything on commercial computers because of relaxation times.
We get into that, so because you mentioned that Phil Anderson and others were sort of got you acquainted with spin glasses, but was that the first time you heard about spin glasses, or were you already aware of them at that point?
You see, it's hard to tell, really. I really don't remember. Presumably, I heard of spin glasses, but they were not part of my interest. I was more interested in quantum field theories, Euclidean quantum field theories on lattices. So they were not random materials per se. I would rather say honestly that I knew about it, but I have not done anything with random materials before, you see. On the other hand, I was quite familiar with and I liked very much stochastic dynamics and stochastic processes in general. So the concepts, you know, of Monte Carlo simulations, say energodicity, were very familiar to me. So I could kind of put two and two together quite quickly, and I simply realized, and I was told, I think, pretty much, that if you want to make, you know, career at Bell Labs, better take the hardest problem there is. Okay, and at this time, nobody absolutely knew anything. What do short range spin glasses do? There was Sherrington Kirkpatrick model, right? Which was reasonably well understood, but it's highly non-physical. Its properties are non-physical. And there were several phenomenological papers to the best of my memory. But the primary source of numerical information was simulations done, among others, by Kurt Binder's group in Germany. So Binder was doing a lot of simulations, and they were too small size, too short time scale. So it was known that nothing is really sure what comes from the situation, simulations. And actually, you know, from the perspective, I later learned that they were just misleading. They're just wrong. So given these three ingredients, Phil Anderson and his colleagues who were theoretically interested in spin glasses and related phenomena, the presence of first-rate experimentalists literally next door from my office, and the necessity of doing something really challenging and interesting to survive, you know, the competition, the labs, right? That led me to just start thinking how on earth I could make progress where I have as much access to a Cray supercomputer as I want, but it's not enough. And then you see what happened was just stars aligned, I would say. At that time, the director of the physics laboratory was Bill Brinkman. You may have heard his name in the context of liquid crystals work. He's been old, Bell Labs old timer, later went on to be president of Sandia Labs. And Bill put me together with Joe Condon. You presumably know the name of Edward Condon, one of the senior physicists involved in the Manhattan Project and the sort of creation of the foundations of quantum mechanics of nuclei in the 30s and 40s. He later became a director of the National Institute of Standards. Then it was called National Bureau of Standards, of course. and gained a lot of fame by his, you know, ethical position during McCarthy era, where so there was a lot of interesting anecdotes about it. But anyway, Joe Condon has been an extremely colorful character, very generous man, and what they had was exactly what I needed. They have built already second or third generation of chess machine. So they are pioneering chess playing machines using off-the-shelf components and simple microprocessors. Don't forget that the first 32-bit microprocessor didn't appear until about 1981 or 80. So they were really small machines. So it seemed that the architecture of the Bell Labs chess machine, which was called Bell, and the architecture of any special purpose computers that could handle this broad class of disordered Ising systems in general, so ferromagnets, anti-ferromagnets, spin glasses, and such, dilution, no dilution, that the architecture was exactly ideal for applying it to very large scale Monte Carlo simulations. And I already have done enough of preliminary calculations and trials to realize that I will have to go to lattices of sizes maybe 64 cubed, which is still very large in any simulation, and maybe even larger, and to extremely long timescales. And here, I mean, I have to be slightly numerical. And I just looked at it yesterday, these papers from this era. So if you take, say, a 64 cube lattice, so you have quite a lot of spins, a quarter million, I think, or something like it. You define one Monte Carlo step, at least the way I did it, as a computing period when each spin in the lattice has a chance to change its state once. Since, you know, you take some random path or regular path through all lattice and give a chance for each spin to change its state depending on local field. That's the Monte Carlo algorithm, right? Idbas algorithm. So to get sensible results, where I could verify that the system was in thermal equilibrium, because that was the key, I had to go to calculations on the order of 10 million to 100 million Monte Carlo steps. So each spin had to be tried, change its position, at least 10 or 100 million times at lower temperatures. At high temperatures, of course, not. So, and that could be achieved, you see. So that's maybe I'll, you know, make a fork here, and I'll put this construction and work with the special purpose computer on a stack for a moment, and just tell you what we did with it. So, in conceptual terms, the special purpose computer was essentially a hardwired subroutine. So the person who wrote the skeleton of the operating system for the special purpose computer was no one other but Ken Thompson, okay, the inventor of Unix. I couldn't be luckier, essentially. Okay, I have Joe Condon with his knowledge of physics and computers on one hand, and Ken Thompson with software. So I did all the, you know, manual labor with putting this thing together. It actually went extremely fast. I mean, I had the working computer in about a year, starting from a, you know, box of chips, essentially. But I was also very motivated, let's put it this way, to finish. And then the research itself essentially consisted in writing a C language program that would call this special box when it was attached to a larger computer, a VAX in this case, okay? And this entire loop over the entire lattice as many times as you wanted in the configuration that you wanted. It was a very flexible machine despite its simplicity. So you see, what I could bring to the discussion about what short range disordered Ising spin systems do was that I could run the simulation as long as it was necessary. And that was the key to the solution. Because I could demonstrate to all non-believers, so to speak, that I could bring the system to thermal equilibrium by running it simply from some initial starting configuration long enough. And then space the sampling of any quantity I wanted, any correlation function, typically, or Edwards-Anderson order parameter and so forth. We measured a lot of things, not really more about it. Sample it in such a way that I could demonstrate reasonable independence and apply statistics to interpretation. So, with gigantic simulations, I was told that they were the largest ever attempted in statistical mechanics as of this time.
Before we dive into this aspect, I was curious about the context of it. Was this idea of building a special purpose computer novel on its own, or was it in the air at the time, or was it something that people had been doing many times over already?
No, not many times over. I think that about the same time there was a group on the West Coast. I think it was Santa Barbara. Again, one of those things that I need to check. They built a different type of special purpose computer, but for reasons that I never understood, they applied it only to two-dimensional Ising model, which is soluble. I think that they just wanted to verify something, that it works. So that was not used for research per se. It was used more as a demonstration of a concept. I did not keep track of it later. Oh, now I remember. One of the, I think, leading members of this group was a guy named Doug Toussaint. He was American, so maybe he pronounced Toussaint, I don't know. And the strangest thing about that project, which was, I think it was contemporaneous, was that they didn't apply it to anything interesting. They were just computing convergence of finite site models to the exact solution of the 2D Ising model. And maybe applied it to 3D Ising model, that too. The other systems, the other researchers, that was actually my colleagues from Bell Labs, was Ravi Bhatt, together with Peter Young, who was then at Imperial College, and I think later went to Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz. They were using one of the early massively parallel computers. It was called DAP, D-A-P. But no, it was not a widely used approach. Building special purpose hardware has its benefits, but also has its shortcomings, right? So the benefit was that I could build myself essentially laboratory equipment, which I could use exclusively as much as I needed. And that was the critical ingredient to get correct results. But I could not, for instance, switch and start calculating, say, problems in protein folding, which was another huge unsolved problem in those days, that we talked a lot about in supercomputing community. So I think that history showed that, that was maybe a window of opportunity when building special purpose machines would win you the day. Bell chess computer was definitely a good example. My little spin glass machine was another example. But then with continuously increasing speed of processors, Moore's law essentially, the general purpose machines became unbeatable. And that's why we use them today. Although the funny thing is that if you look inside your iPhone, you'll realize that there is many specialized processors for, among other things, for instance, video processing. So we ended up with sort of, parts that are special purpose, parts that are general purpose, but purely special purpose computers, I think, had this short-lived window where there was nothing that you could use as an alternative.
Can I ask you something related to this? Because before you mentioned the fact that you were familiar with lattice gauge theories, and so I was wondering, I mean, I've heard several times that people were interested in spin glasses also because it was a kind of simple example of a kind of lattice gauge theory where you have some variables that are dynamical and other variables that are quenched, like in some approximation of QCD. So I was wondering if this was an inspiration for you, and also in the field of lattice gauge theories, people have been developing special purpose computers too. So did you have interactions with them? I mean, was there any kind of connection between these two fields at the time?
Quite close, actually. It's especially on personal level. So I developed, as soon as, say, the knowledge spread that I have this super duper toy for Monte Carlo at Bell Labs, I got a fairly large number of invitations to give invited talks. Both in national labs, but also in other academic groups that were doing large-scale Monte Carlo for QCD, of course, right? Quantum chromodynamics. I was particularly close with Norman Crist, I think he was pronouncing his name, at Columbia. They were up and with a group at Oak Ridge. I also had quite a bit of interactions with a group from Lawrence Livermore, and presumably other groups that I don't recall right now. But there was a big distinction, you see, because of heavy emphasis on floating point calculations in lattice quantum chromodynamics. They were rather proceeding in the direction of multiprocessors. So essentially they were taking single card computers and putting dozens, sometimes hundreds, and now thousands of them in a box. So a very different architecture. They were really networked general purpose computers. So yes, we were in touch. We were talking a lot about what can be done and what cannot be done and so forth, and what technologies we are using for design. And yes, I'm familiar with these people and with these groups. Like I told you, I think just because of physical distance between Bell Labs in Murray Hill and New York City, I was a frequent visitor and vice versa with Norm Crist's laboratory.
So the work you did that you published on these machines, and at least some of the first ones, were actually with a former Binder student, right? Ingo Morgenstern.
He actually came when I was more or less done with it.
Okay.
He was a visiting postdoc, I think, at Bell Laboratories when I finished building this machine already. So he was, of course, engaged because, you know, he came with knowledge of spin glasses too, but he did not participate in the project of the special purpose computer and writing the software to operate it. And then later he went back to Germany. We kept talking. I think that one of the more interesting conferences on spin glasses from this perspective was in Heidelberg, I think in 86. So I saw him next there again.
So you mentioned how the computational physicists, in a sense, reacted to your work and they were enthusiastically responding. What was the spin glass community? Could you describe what was the reaction to that work?
I would say very positive. First of all, I want to stress it was not just spin glass. There was this whole category right now of related, conceptually related, not physically related, materials, which in spin context, say in statistical mechanics context, we generally call them, say, random field Ising models, dilute antiferromagnets, spin glasses of various kinds, and so forth. So I think that from the perspective of experimentalists, the biggest pleasure I had, and I think contributions that I made, was that I have developed parsimonious method of parameterizing various functions. In particular, functions describing this very slow non-exponential relaxation that's characteristic of glassy materials. And I used essentially Clausius' law corrected with a power law. So essentially product of a power law decay and Clausius decay. And I was able to, given that I had very accurate data with very small error bars, precisely because I could achieve such high statistics in simulations, I could parameterize these curves pretty well. And there are good intuitive reasons why to choose such things, right? Because as short range and later long range order develops, you do expect inverse Power's law for the decay of correlation functions. And when you have kind of cluster dynamics, which incidentally was being developed at the same time, among others by Dan Fisher, I think David Hughes, myself, Chris Henley, who was then at Bell Labs postdoc. So Clausius was also kind of expected. Not to mention, of course, that people in the chemistry of glasses, like real glasses, like not spin glasses, have been using Clausius type functions for quite a bit of time. So anyway, to make a long story short, with this parameterization, I was able to establish a common language with large number of experimentalists who immediately could relate their data among themselves and to simulations. One of particularly interesting cases was the power law decay in ordered or quasi-ordered, say, stages of those materials when you have very slow power law decay. The exponents governing this decay are very large, actually, about 7 or so. That's a parameter Z for dynamic correlation functions. And I very quickly established a relationship with a number of labs, with Vince's lab in Santa Barbara, Majdosh's lab in Leiden, several labs in the United States, and so forth. I mean, that again, I would have to start looking more at particular names. But I think that we could express the numerical findings and experimental findings using the same type of formulas, same type of parameterizations. So that was one. The second, say, relation that I had with experimentalists was that I think in particular with Laurent Levy, who worked in Doug Osherov's lab, was a study of nonlinear susceptibilities in spin glasses. Given, like I mentioned to you, my interest in stochastic dynamics, at some point I went on an errand and actually recalculated from scratch the formulas for all dynamic correlation functions, that is using the expansion of the generating function. Yeah, I mean, turned out that there were some mistakes in the textbook formulas. And using these formulas, Laurent Levy did a beautiful experiment measuring, I think, up to the eights. I have to look at somewhere. But it was a real tour de force. Let me just see if I have it. One paper. Well, this is something that I have to add, in the correction to what I say. But demonstration that you could numerically calculate higher order susceptibilities quite well, and that in well performed clean experiments, you can do the same. And again, you could relate one to another. So that was another thing that we did. And in theoretical community, I thought that it was good to have a clean cut answer that within our existing limitations of dealing with finite systems, which actually was the largest that I could do at this time, largest that anybody could do, the scaling laws in particular were completely consistent with the existence of second-order phase transition in 3D Ising spin glasses, discrete distribution of bonds in plus-minus J models, so-called. So that created quite a bit of interest. Second thing was, maybe scientifically not very deep, but illuminated the shortcomings of less careful simulations. And that was the most visible feature in simulations of spin glasses was that specific heat develops a peak, okay? But there is no order of any kind in the system. So people were thinking that that's a signal of a phase transition. It turns out that it's only a signal of short range order that develops. And spin glass ordering appears at much lower temperature than the peak of specific heat. This peak, by the way, does not develop a singularity, it's just a rounded hump, kind of, because it's created by short range ordering of the system. So that, I think, was the first very interesting thing. The second very interesting thing in interactions with theorists came from a different angle. And that was, I had always interest in geometry and stochastic dynamics, like I told you. So I started analyzing the low temperature states of spin glasses, what exactly they are. Perhaps, you know, the best account of it is in the article I wrote for this 1986 conference on spin glasses in Heidelberg. The rest is mostly unpublished notes because at this time I was changing career already. And I could say a lot about the ideas, how droplet models of hierarchical dynamics could be realized in Ising spin glasses, how frustration actually helps propagate the long range order in spin glasses. That again, that is in this Heidelberg lecture. And I developed very close connections with the earliest work on neural networks. You see, it just so happened again, that's the beauty of Bell Laboratories, that John Hopfield had an office exactly one flight of stairs above me. So when John Hopfield started talking and writing about the simple, you know, feed-forward neural networks and feedback neural networks and using them as model of memory, right? He was familiar with this. I could be looking at the same phenomena of cluster dynamics in my models of spin glasses. So I also started working with people in directly in Phil Anderson's orbit. By then, Phil already went to Princeton after mid-80s. And I just lucked out, you know, and found that simple models of hierarchical relaxation can actually be solved exactly. You recall maybe that the problem was that most of theoretical physics known in the early 80s, late 70s, had a real problem deriving non-exponential and non-power law decay, time decay phenomena, how to describe them. And there were all these Kolmogorov functions, Fokker functions and whatnot. And we realized that random walks on trees are solvable and can produce exactly this type. That was a paper with Dan Stein, a short physical review letters paper that generated a lot of interest too. Because somehow, you see, that started very directly bridging spin glasses with all other theoretical endeavors that dealt with very many stable or metastable states. That was also Phil Anderson's interest. That's where he started talking about evolution theory, evolution of species, as you know. And it all was kind of formulated in terms of energy landscapes, which I think for Phil were originally coming, of course, from quantum mechanics of molecules and solids, you know, with Born-Oppenheimer approximation. But this concept of energy landscapes started relating it all together. So I very quickly related my work to a work of people dealing with say, application of spinglass thinking to neural networks, this application of spinglass-like thinking to evolution theory, and to the entire group, actually, that started creating the Santa Fe Institute. So that was very interesting. I also had pleasure, you know, of spending a lot of time with Steve Wolfram. Steve at the time was postdoc at Bell Labs for a year or two before going to, for 2 years, I think, to Institute for Advanced Physics in Princeton, Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. So I would say it was a very good time to be able to come with concrete answers in at least this one category of spin glasses that I studied, because that field was related with so many other fields, not even neighboring fields, quite distinctly separate. And it opened another doors too, because I don't know if you remember or you read about it, but it was in one of these very illogical phenomena in American, say, mass media, the early 80s, when I was doing this work, were filled with panic that Japan is going to overtake United States in supercomputing. Japan announced something called fifth generation supercomputing at the time. And nobody else but Al Gore, whom you know from different perspectives presumably, became a great proponent and proselytizer of supercomputing. Somehow I also was used to some extent, I would say, by people who are pushing for growth of supercomputing in the United States. And one of the amusing stories that happened to me was that I was featured in an article in Business Week with my little supercomputer, and it helped me to get the mortgage, which was a really funny thing. But anyway, there you go. So yes, there have been very close connections between what I was doing and neighboring fields. Some results maybe could be transported directly to what other people are doing. Some were maybe more conceptually related. I would say that in a research sense, the most related aspects of my work was the fact that there is all kinds of cluster dynamics going on in spin glasses, it seems. And after I stopped working in this field, this, I understand, made quite a lot of progress.
So before we move to that latter part, I was curious, you've mentioned Phil Anderson's name a number of times. How much did you interact with him as part of that research or more broadly at Bell Labs?
In a literal sense, almost daily, because you know, like in many physics departments, and there was this nice custom of afternoon tea in the laboratory. So you were supposed to show up at 3 p.m. sharp in a small room in close to our offices in Murray Hill and talk to everybody about, you know, most intelligent things that came to your mind, right? So Phil's office was like two doors down the hallway from this coffee room, as we called it, or small conference room, I think it was called. So he was, whenever he was in the laboratories, and he usually spent a lot of time in Bell Labs, he would show up and we would chat briefly. And I learned a lot. I think the biggest lesson I learned from Phil was that it really pays to spend enormous amount of time with data. And he certainly helped me build this motivation to spend so much time analyzing the data, making sure that it's right, you see, that I have control over statistical errors, and most importantly, that I have control over systematic errors, because they are the real devil, as you know, right? I mean, pure statistics you can handle, but systematic errors can kill you. So that was very helpful. I also went and visited him a few times for a longer conversations, obviously, also after he left and spent more of his time in Princeton. I extremely much enjoyed, you know, talking. Other people that I spent a lot of time working at Bell Labs I would say David Hughes, who is now professor in Princeton, Dan Fisher. I spent quite a lot of time with Chris Henley, who was a very interesting character. I don't know if you knew him. Did you?
He was at Cornell, right?
Yeah. Yes. He later went to Cornell, and as luck, bad luck had it, he died of brain cancer when he wasn't even 60. So he did some very nice work with droplet and cluster dynamics. So he spent a lot of time, and he was pressing me to dig deeper and deeper into data to identify this normal modes of the stochastic of master equation, right? Eigenvectors of the master equation generator matrix. Let's see, Dan Fisher, who else? Another good thing at the Bell Labs was that at that time you were supposed to be in the office. There was no working from home, of course. So we all went to lunch together, and Murray Hill has a very large cafeteria. So again, the discussions across disciplines and across people and with people from various laboratories went on at lunches. So that was, again, a fantastic vehicle, you see, to connect what I was doing with interests of other people. Incidentally, also in more engineering groups at Bell Labs, not only in physics.
So you left the spinning glass and disordered system work, at least from the physics standpoint, around 1987, 1988.
That's correct.
So, I mean, you mentioned that you got interested in other problems. What was there a drive, a particular drive to that change of direction?
Yes, you see, I mean, having spent such a big effort to design with Joe Condon and then build and wire the special purpose computer, it's actually a sizable box, you know. It's about, I don't know, about 2 by 1 by 2 feet kind of. No box with, we used VME bus, which was then a standard. So it was sizable kind of memory and processor cards inserted into it. So I had to absorb, you see, essentially in 1 year, everything that was done in automated logic design, because we used a lot of programmable chips to create this machine, and software design and some small-scale networking as well. So I naturally got very much interested in supercomputing and computer-related questions. So in 1988, I think, or late 87, presumably. I don't remember the date exactly. I think late 87. I transferred from theoretical physics to the mathematics department at Bell Laboratories. Maths department at that time was run by Ron Graham. You must have heard of Ron Graham, I suppose. He was not only an extraordinary discrete mathematician, but also a phenomenal juggler. He was actually the president of the World's Union of Jugglers, if you didn't know that. And he was also a great supporter of Paul Erdős. Okay, so Paul Erdős, he traveled essentially with a suitcase and didn't have a home, and was just working with people and then moving to the next place to write another paper. So Ron Graham was a great supporter of Paul Erdős, and as a result, I mean, Bell Labs had presumably one of the strongest groups in discrete mathematics at that time. But also it was a birthplace of Unix, you see. So there was always a need for more people sort of in applied math area. So I spent a couple of years in applied mathematics group there. And it was a group dealing with computer networks primarily. I did some work on Boolean neural networks and stuff like this. And then you see, I became so engaged in this that when Bell Labs split, you may remember that Bell Labs lost the anti-monopoly, antitrust lawsuit filed by the Department of Justice. The irony had it that IBM has won the independence and was not broken up, but AT&T was broken up into pieces, okay, by the Justice Department. And the Bell Labs itself split into two. One was remained Bell Labs, and the other was called Bellcore. You may have heard of it. It still exists, but it's not what it was. So this created opportunities for advancement. And I became a manager at Bellcore until about 1996. So in this time, I was 100% involved in supercomputing. It was my primary interest in massively parallel computing. At this point, I did essentially no physics anymore. I was fully busy with new duties. I was a department head at some point. I had two departments under my management. And as they say, it's with time I may have crossed to the dark side, but it was not all bad, you see.
So did you nonetheless remain in touch with some of the spinning glass and optimization people in Europe who were looking more on the computer science side of these questions? Oh,
very much so. I mean, I continued going to conferences on the subjects. I think several of them I remember particularly pleasantly, like for instance, when I met Benoit Mandelbrot, who was a fantastic raconteur and very colorful figure. So I spent a lot of time with him at some conference in Nas. I think it was in Santa Cruz or Santa Barbara, I don't remember. I continued going for some time to Institute of Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara. But eventually I have completely moved to supercomputing, you see. And then when the internet ban on, I mean, you remember that the US government did not permit corporations to use the internet because it was a government program. So you had to be an academic or had a special exemption to use it. Bellcore got this special exemption. So we had internet. Bell Labs did not use internet in late 80s, like 88, 89. Bell Labs, of course, you see, you had this, one of the features of big organizations which are not good, and that is not invented here syndrome. So Bell Labs invented their own internet working. It was very elegant, actually, but it was not internet, not IP protocol. Bell Labs invented their own bitmapped terminals. Well, but you know, again, it was not written in open source software, okay? And Bell Labs invented its own email, which again was a different kind. So my eyes were open to the possibilities of the internet protocols and implementation of the internet in real life when I was at Bellcore as well. And that was essentially, you know, my third career, physics, supercomputing, internet, engineering, I would say. It kind of grew one from another quite naturally.
So you mentioned that how your experience with supercomputers served you in your second career, as you describe it. But was the physics of spin glasses influential at all, or did that not persist
Actually, it did, but in a different incarnation altogether, in the incarnation that I practice to this day, actually. Through the first connections through Santa Fe Institute and, say, Anderson's interest in evolution and related things, I got drawn to study biology as well. And I was lucky enough to, you know, be able to spend several weeks each year at Woods Hole Marine Biology Laboratory when I was at Bellcore. It was a perk that I could use. I could steer my own research. And this persisted to this day. So I would say that the understanding of this enormous group of problems that deals with disordered systems, collective behavior, slow relaxation. Think proteins, of course, here, right? That was this related problem at this time. Kept me busy looking at the real biological system. And, you know, I have retired from physics, but I continue doing some research in biology, which actually happened to more than myself. I think quite a few people went this way. So I think that this big, big, you know, basket of problems related to spin glasses had quite enormous impact on multiplicity of disciplines, not just purely in mathematical sense, but also in conceptual sense, that we could carry over various concepts to other fields, you see?
I have a curiosity, a slightly tangent question. I noticed that you wrote a grant with one of my now Duke colleagues in the late 90s, Ingrid Dobeschi. Did you actually ever work together, or was this just a
one? Oh, yes. Actually, Ingrid and I were both postdocs at Bell Laboratories. I think we overlapped somewhat. I mean, I think I was there already when Ingrid joined. And she did beautiful work on wavelets at that time. I mean, yes, we have remained in touch. And that was some completely different direction that related to internet research now. So you see, when I was at Bellcore, we were approached by several academics if we would participate in modeling of various aspects of the internet. And you see, the key point, the key knowledge that I could bring to it is that I had the reputation of a guy who would take enormously large problems, that I could actually somehow, one way or another, finagle resources, money, to conduct very large numerical studies, very large simulations. So I think the first grant proposal that we did was with Walter Willinger. He was at Bellcore. With Ingrid Dobeschi. I tried to remember, there were several more people. There was a guy from Stanford, a statistician. I'll make
a note. Yeah, David Donohoe, I think.
Oh yeah, of course, David Donohoe. Yeah, how could I forget? I mean, I was living near Dartmouth and he sent his son to Dartmouth and we had another nice discussion. Yeah. And so the point of this proposal, if I remember, was essentially to apply this very large scale analytics, data analytics, based on wavelets and other multi-scale phenomena, and to simulations. And my role was to put together this really big simulations going. Another partner in crime was a guy named David Nicol. Last time I heard of him, he has been a professor at Urbana-Champaign, I think. So we actually did incredibly well. And after a Bellcore pretty much shut down, you know, the Bellcore was in 95 or 96, was sold, 96, I think, was sold to SAIC, the large defense contractor, Science Application International Corporation. And it became much less attractive place. So I left and I became a professor at Rutgers for several years. And all these years and few years longer, I had funding from DARPA and from NSF. So this grant that you discovered, but Ingrid and Donohoe and others were partners, was renewed, I think, at least twice. And later I got fairly sizable DARPA grants. And that was for building the largest possible simulations of the global internet. So I think one of the papers that made waves in this community was where we demonstrated that we can simulate 1 million computer nodes in a network the size of the United States. That was quite exciting period. So that was another, say, focus of my activity were very large-scale supercomputing applied to a problem that was not resolved, became successful. The problem, you see, was that typical simulation in networking those days were essentially dealing with issues of, say, queue management. So we had several processes creating packets, you know, small scale, small things. And the question we tried to answer was, what happens if I connect 10,000 or 100,000 sources of data flows and let them interact in various topologies? And we actually got it. And we succeeded. Another nice feature is for people who are related to critical phenomena, say, was that power loss are ubiquitous in telecommunications as well, through a different mechanism. You presumably saw somewhere papers showing that the telecommunications fluctuations of packet traffic are not Gaussian. They are more like 1/f noise. So they have this scale invariant type of nature over very many decades. So again, you have to simulate for very long times to achieve something that makes sense. And we could achieve this. This time, however, we're using commercially available multiprocessor machines, like very large Sun computers, things of this nature.
Francesco, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to know a little bit more about, I think a big part of the spin glass community towards the end of the 80s moved into the field of neural networks and computer science. And in particular, in Paris, people around like Marc Mézard and also Elizabeth Garner, Bernard Derrida, and there was a group also in Israel. So did you have any connection or interactions with these people?
Very, very close, actually. regarding Israel, Chaim Sompolinsky was a very frequent visitor to Bell Laboratories. So I spent hours and hours and hours talking with Chaim. I think that the area where we overlapped most was this cluster structure of the low temperature phase of Ising spin glasses. He was very much, and I already mentioned that the same type of conversations were going on with John Hopfield, who was in the same building where I was before moving full time to West Coast. So yes, Chaim Sompolinsky and his group, that was definitely one type of interactions. I do remember, I was looking at some notes from the past yesterday evening just to remember the names better. I know that I had quite a bit of interactions with Gérard Toulouse, with Cyrano de Dominici, and with, but I don't think we ever, I do not believe we ever carried out, well-defined research together. I would characterize it rather as, mutually illuminating or stimulating conversations in the subject. I did some work in neural networks themselves when I was in the MAS Center, Mathematics Center at Bell Laboratories, but I was discouraged with the fact that the field was not progressing very well at that time. There was more hype than meat those days. I think that we know the answer why, right? And through work done at Google in particular and Facebook now. What was missing in those early days was understanding that the power of neural networks appears only when you use truly extraordinarily large amounts of data for training. And I don't think there was the understanding those days. So this neural networks that were studied those days are sort of toy models, we would call it today. And again, it was simply, you know, another way of saying that size matters, right? That you really have to do it on a large scale with enormously large volumes of data for training and for cross-verification. And I think that that's what created what is now, you know, leading the computer industry with applications, say, from Google or Apple or Facebook and such, right? Actually, I even saw beautiful works, right, very recently using neural networks for solution of partial differential equations in density functional theory. I mean, I love it. I mean, it's, again, you have to do it big, you see? So I think that this theme, if there is one theme in my research life, it has been that if you deal with a problem where you cannot really cut corners and you have to deal with it in a proper size, on a proper time duration, and that's maybe has been one common kind of motive. So I would say so these three kind of clusters of research I did, spin glasses and related materials, supercomputing and internet simulation.
So during your time at Bell Labs or at Rutgers or elsewhere, did you ever get to teach about spinning glasses or replica symmetry breaking ideas or ultrametricity? And if yes, could you detail a bit what?
Okay, not teach in the sense of teaching courses. I was participating in various conferences or in Aspen School of Physics, where I would give lectures about my work, or about, if not necessarily my work, about the problems in this category, statistical mechanical approach to the spin glass and random magnetic material problems. But no, I have not been teaching courses at the time. When I was at Rutgers, I was a professor at Rutgers sometime between 1996, I think, and 1999. At the end of 99, something like it. But I was a professor in electrical engineering. And then that was another kind of big scale computing that we did. Then it's also interesting in its own right. You see, in the late 90s, the challenge for industry, networking in particular, was that it became what has been clearer and clearer that internet is going wireless, okay? And at the same time, the protocols at the core of the internet, and in particular here, TCP is worth mentioning, were developed for wired systems. And the nature of problem is completely different. In wired systems, especially of the earlier era when people were building the first internet, the packet losses were due to congestion. And in wireless, they are simply due to noise and corruption. Okay, completely different mechanism. So long story short, the internet protocols and wireless protocols are completely mismatched because they try to address different problems for quality control. So we have created, a very large software test bed for testing interaction of internet protocols and wireless link layer protocols. I was at a group called WinLab at Rutgers. So it's a wireless network research laboratory, which actually was populated mostly by ex-Bell Labs guys, not only from physics, but also from Holmdel, from radio departments and cellular telephony departments. And this has been a very successful project again. I think, I keep hitting this big computational problem somehow. So I was teaching, I had maybe a couple dozen graduate students over this time, several of them PhD. Got their PhD, they got master's degrees. But I was not teaching courses. I was teaching informal sort of style, how to analyze radio channels using, say, starting with Maxwell equations and ending up with computer program. So different thing. Mm-hmm.
So is there anything else that you would like to share with us that we might have skipped over about this era that you think might be relevant?
I would constantly keep coming to this extraordinarily exciting, you know, environment where people from different fields were spending lots of time together. And in some way, I think the idea of Santa Fe Institute, which actually was supposed to look very different than what it is, arose in the mid-80s, precisely to bring together people, you know, with interests in biology, neurobiology, physics, and actually spin glasses in particular. I think that Phil Anderson, David Pines, and Mary Gelman, there was maybe more, a couple of more people, senior people who were creating this idea. They have had more of an idea of an independent new type of university rather than, you know, the sort of visitor-driven lab as it is today. But I think that their expectations for funding were did not meet reality, okay? So I think that the most important item in my memory of the 80s is this broadly interdisciplinary connections, and that I was able myself, you know, it's extremely pleasant, move between computer science, hardware design, physics, touch a little on biology. It was very stimulating. And, you know, and all the people who were there were absolutely fascinating people. I mean, at this time we had, I mean, when I was there, a postdoc, Duncan Haldane was a postdoc. I mean, Sue Coppersmith was a postdoc. There was a lot of really good, you know, Pierce Coleman, Chris Henley, I mean, Steve Wolfram, Boris Schreiman. I mean, these are great physicists, all of them, and they were all young, you know, and we were spending a lot of time talking about pretty much everything. So that's, I think, the strongest impression that stayed with me.
So do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
You see, this was not the email era yet. Okay, email was just appearing. And as we were very much worried then that what's on email is going to disappear forever. Actually, the opposite happened. The papers disappeared with time and email is forever. No, not very much. I just saw some very pleasant letters that I obtained, you know, from Cyrano de Dominici or Gerard Toulouse. But we usually had secretaries keep them in folders. And moving with companies and companies splitting, much of this stuff sort of, you know, disappeared into obscurity somewhere.
Thank you very much for your time. This was a very enjoyable conversation.
Well, it was fun talking to you guys. I don't get much to talk about spin glasses anymore. So presumably I forgot dozens of people who were helpful and with whom I enjoyed working, and dozens of laboratories that I visited, but maybe I'll have a chance to add something in the notes.
Thank you.